Welcome to Societal Shapers, a podcast by PL Cadilla, the place to get inspired, find your purpose and courage, and get tools to become the next female leader, creating real results and meaningful changes.
I'm your host, PL, and today I have Thayera. Let me give you a little bit of background about Thayera, and she will also introduce herself, and then we'll jump straight into the questions. So one of the reasons I've been really excited and waiting for this day to be able to interview Thayera is because she has been one of my coaches in our Women Empowerment coaching sessions held last year. And I think, you know, she's been working on some amazing things, and I've been waiting for her to finally say yes to this recording. So we are finally here. I'm going to share with you a bit of background. So Thayera actually recently completed her PhD in Media and Communications in 2019. And she also holds a master's degree in mass comms from the University of Leicester, UK. She has about 20 years of higher education experience teaching and management in leading universities. And her doctoral thesis examines the media representation of women in Malaysia. So our topic today is going to be predominantly about this and something else. So Thayera's passion is empowering women, particularly on protecting women and girls from violence and gender inequality. And she was a member of several women's organizations, such as AWAM, which stands for All Women's Action Society of Malaysia, and Wibawa Women, a society that I'm also a member of. As a volunteer, she's actively delivered public education programs on gender issues to secondary school students in Peninsula Malaysia. She's currently writing a book on the representation of women in the Malaysian media on the issue of gender violence. So this is actually the second part that we're going to dive deep into and find out a bit more about her research and findings. Okay, so Thayera, over to you. Is there anything else you would like to add on to the introduction? You know, feel free to do so.
Okay, thanks, PL, for that introduction. And it's great to see you after, I don't know how many months that we've not seen each other. And also, I think importantly, I'd like to thank you for providing this space for women empowerment. I think it's truly a celebration of the contribution that women are making in every aspect of society, from, you know, being a mother, a worker, and a leader. So you've provided a very important space for women. So I think what I'd like to add, probably, you know, before we start on, is probably just a bit of my background. So I grew up in Penang, and interestingly, I grew up with very strong women, you know, one of which particularly was my grandmother, who she had 7 children, and what was very important for her, she wanted to go to school, she wanted to be educated, but she ended up, you know, during those days, she got married and had 7 kids, and she found that very frustrating. And out of her 7 children, she had 3 daughters, and it was her 3 daughters that she made sure went to university. They were very poor. They were from Tapah Perak, and 3 of my aunties went to university. 2 of them got a PhD. And then that empowered my mom, you know, and my mom then, you know, inspired me, because she was a women activist. She was very much involved with the Women Crisis Center in Malaysia. And also she's written on women's issues. So, you know, I've been very, very blessed and lucky to have women surrounding me that's inspired me. But importantly, also my father, who always believed that a woman should be, you know, economically strong, financially independent, as well as, you know, to have a very good education. So I would say, you know, these were my peer support that I grew up and made me who I am today.
Thank you, Thayera. I think that's brilliant that, you know, what you've just brought out there is that family is so important. And it's really interesting to hear that you've got a lineage of very strong and empowered women who's basically shaped your path today.
Yes.
So well done on all the accomplishments of being, you know, the person that you are today. Biggest gratitude to your grandmother, and as well as your aunties and your mom as well.
Yes. Okay.
And also your dad, you know, so that's amazing.
Yes.
Okay, so let's dive in deeper into this thesis, right? So what drove you to write a thesis on women's representation in the media? Very interesting.
Okay, so I think, you know, there were 2 main aspects of why I wanted to do a thesis in this area. The first, of course, is that because I have worked as a media studies lecturer at Taylor's University for about 7 years. And I was teaching media and communication subjects. So, you know, that has been, you know, my expertise, and I've always been interested in the way media represented different issues. The second is, of course, like you just read in my bio, you know, it's always been my passion in empowering women, particularly on women and girls from violence and gender inequality. And like I said earlier, you know, my mom had influenced me a lot on this topic. And because I have these two topics that I'm very interested in, and I'm very passionate about media and women, I've decided to do a PhD on how women are represented. I did two main case studies between 2014 to 2018, because, you know, a PhD takes 4 to 5 years. And I took two particular case studies and see how did the Malaysian media, particularly online newspaper, talked and cover about this issue, you know, basically, how's the news narrative? So I looked at it obviously from a media perspective, and that was the topic of my PhD thesis.
So that's very interesting, right? So normally, you know, whenever we do write about, or we write, or we talk about, or we fight for social injustices, so, most times it's because either we have gone through something personal.
Yes.
And therefore, that kind of fires us up, right? So the reason why I'm so passionate about women empowerment, because I have, you know, personal challenges going through, for example, a divorce and then having to become a single mom, etc. So what were your, you know, personal activators that basically got you really passionate into this topic?
I think, seeing a lot of injustice living in Malaysia like you, you know, looking at friends and families, and like you said, you know, your personal experiences of women being discriminated on many grounds. I used to remember when I went back home to my grandmother's house, which is, you know, in the kampung, you can see, you know, women crying, you know, in the village, because either they've been abused by their husband, or their husband's taken on another woman, you know, second wife. And so you see a lot of injustice around you, and, you know, experiencing yourself, firsthand life experiences as well, would spark that kind of interest beyond, like, I agree with you, it's not just theoretical and, you know, something abstract concepts, which what academics like to do. So, you know, this would be a perspective of lived experiences, something that I see around me, and of course, an interest in an area that I'm also teaching. So yeah, it's a combination of everything.
So that's great. I mean, you know, because of the experiences and your touch points, seeing and watching other people, that's really kept you inspired, and you're actually doing something about it. So that's most important, right? So tell us, going back into your thesis, tell us a bit more about, you know, what are the most interesting parts or findings in your thesis?
Okay. I think importantly, just to touch, you know, like why the media, because the media, if we look at it, are very powerful sources of information on culture, you know, shaping norms, attitudes on public discourse and gender. So the media is actually not just reporting news. They're actually contemporary storytellers on issues. And they actually influence the public a lot, you know, especially now with social media, we are influenced with all kinds of news. And the media itself is actually influenced by political, religious and cultural conditions. So Malaysia is actually quite unique as compared to, you know, America or the UK or even Singapore. They're actually quite different. And then when you said about, did you ask me about the findings? What did I find?
Yes, right.
Okay, so the two case studies that I looked at was, one was Sisters in Islam. I know you interviewed Suri Kempe.
Yes. Right.
Yeah, so she's amazing. So I looked at the fatwa against Sisters in Islam that happened in 2014, and I think it's still ongoing. And how did the news actually report, you know, an issue like this? The second case study I actually looked at was, again, I'm looking at news narrative. If you're familiar with Farah N. Hadi, she's our Malaysian gymnast.
Yeah,
so in 2014, she won 6 medals at the SEA Games, and she had a controversy regarding her dress code, which was a standard gymnast attire. And it was covered not only in Malaysia, but around the world, you know, BBC and all that covered it. Of course, I looked at how the media in Malaysia actually presented this story about Farah as well as Sisters in Islam. So interestingly, what I found, like in Sisters in Islam, the case, for example, on this fatwa, the online newspapers like The Star, indirectly, they actually either support or challenge the fatwa. You know, there's either, you know, in the news narrative, there are two perspectives. So it wasn't just direct reporting of, you know, oh, Sisters in Islam is challenging the fatwa, but it was more of, you know, within the news narratives, they either say, yes, you should challenge the fatwa or no. So for example, the Star newspaper, the Star Online, I noticed news narratives did say, you know, is Sisters in Islam right to challenge the fatwa? So they're very supportive. And they even come out with a lot of articles saying things like, you know, they've helped so many Muslim women. And as such, how could Sisters in Islam be considered as deviant? Because that's what the fatwa was saying, you know, Sisters in Islam is deviant, deviating. Whereas the Malay newspapers, you know, like Utusan and all that, they actually said that you shouldn't be challenging the fatwa, you know, once it's been issued, you shouldn't be challenged, and the fact that you're challenging, you're even more deviant. So it's interesting that news is actually having a perspective of, you know, whether they should and they shouldn't through all their narratives. Well, with regards to Farah and Hadi, it was very similar as well. You know, like the Star was very, in a way, indirectly supportive, saying that she should be allowed to choose what she's wearing, you know, whether she wants to wear a, you know, gymnast clothes or, you know, what else. The Malay papers, again, they did not directly criticize her, but they did say Farah Ann should have conformed to specific religious norms, you know, and follow that kind of attire rather than what she's wearing. So yeah. It's interesting. Yeah.
So this is really interesting, right? So how do you think that this has now shaped the general population of Malaysia, particularly Malay Muslim women?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the media themselves has an image of what a Malay Muslim woman is like. That was the interesting part. So a newspaper like The Star looks at a Malay Muslim woman that's more, I guess, moderate and liberal in terms of her understanding. Whereas the Malay newspapers have a more... I think, you know, it's more of a Malay woman that's compliant to all the norms and religious and cultural norms. So the media themselves is not a homogeneous understanding of what a Malay woman is. They all have their own concept. And I thought that was very interesting. So there's not one idea. There's, you know, many ideas of what a Malay woman in this context, or like Sisters in Islam, should be like, what should, you know, Sisters in Islam should do when this happened to them.
Yeah, so that's interesting, right? So, you know, as we mentioned that how, you know, media shapes our narrative of what a Malay Muslim woman should look like. Yeah. And so as a result of this, do you think that it has also influenced the way how the Muslim Malay women today think? And therefore, are we actually progressing or are we actually digressing as a society?
I think, you know, again, the media depends what media people are reading, because as you know, no, none of us read across, like I looked at 10 media. So, you know, you have, I'm sure like you have particular media that you look at, you know, like, you know, friends more Malaysia Kini, some more Star, and some of my friends read more the Malay papers. So I think, you know, that shows the inclination of what you're reading and how it influences you, because the readers themselves are different. Whether Malay women are progressing or they're not progressing, I think that looks at more of the, you know, the whole societal structures and you know, laws that's existing as well. Because the media, it's more of a storyteller function. But beyond that, there are other issues that affects women, as you know, like, you know, laws like, you know, child bride and all that. So that's itself is a different platform altogether.
Yeah. So when you looked at these case studies, did you also have to suggest solutions, come up with recommendations in terms of, you know, so what was the conclusion of it?
Well, I guess in a media studies angle, we usually would suggest studies in the future So obviously I was looking at the time of Najib's era during his administration, where, you know, at that time, politically, religious and culture was very different. And now we have a total different political landscape altogether. So there is a lot of what you call suggestion of having research done in this current context. And that's what I was promoting or suggesting in terms of my research. And of course, the research is something that you can duplicate, which means that whatever I've done in terms of the methodology and the structures and all that is something that you can duplicate and do it something existing now under a different political structure.
So what in terms of, you know, what I'm also very curious, right? So we know that there are biases, particularly in the media, depending on, you know, what their narrative of a Malay woman should look, right? So in terms of our personal experience, so kind of like cutting into the real thing, the real talk, right? As being an urban-based, growing up in the city and having, you know, friends who've been quite privileged, etc., we have a very different outlook towards what modernity actually represents and entails, you know, in terms of like the freedom of how we practice the religion and how we express our interpretation of our belief in our religion. And so what I also see in terms of the narrative of the Muslim Malay women is that it seems to kind of like also change with seasons according to the political leadership, as you mentioned, right?
Yes.
So previously, you know, under the Najib's government, and today we have a different political party. And so it seems to like also shift and shape the way how women are perceived. So for example, you know, we have a new women minister that leads yes. our Ministry of Women and Family Affairs. And so, you know, when she started out, there were some things which were, I feel personally, derogatory towards women and the way yes. how we should behave around our husbands, right?
Yes,
and
during the MCO, yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, we know that a big base of Malay women read the Malay news, right?
Yeah.
So we cannot escape that. And therefore, even to want to diversify how we consume information is difficult because, you know, people don't speak English. Therefore, people don't understand English. And even if they do read it, you kind of question how much they can take out of it, right? So that's the worry in terms of, you know, just reading one perspective because you're limited by the language and therefore the arguments that comes with it. You're kind of buying into the media's biases.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I'm curious to know, like, in your findings, what are the, you know, things that maybe went into the thesis or just your own personal opinion in terms of how do we then help or support or empower the majority of this base to actually help them have more perspective into, you know, their beliefs of how a Muslim woman should behave and be?
Okay, it's a very good question, Pial, but like I said, you know, my area is predominantly on news narrative and a media scholar. And in the past, when I actually had presented this, I did have a lot of people sort of asking me other questions, for example, you know, pertaining to, let's say, like, you know, Islam and women and all that. And that's actually specifically not my, you know, the area that I would like to even touch upon because it's actually a different domain. So, you know, coming back to mine was predominantly looking at the news itself. But you're right. Every time when there's a new political structure and a new political party, the position of women changes. And you're right, it's not fluid. So, you know, the ideal women or the conditions of a Muslim or Malay woman does change according to what, you know, the current scenario is like within, you know, politically is actually very important. And of course, the social landscape, the cultural landscape. So there are many factors that actually influence the women's position in society.
Interesting. Okay, so I'm going to move on into the book that you're writing, because I think then we'll have a bit more room to maneuver in terms of your personal opinions as well. So, you know, thank you for sharing on a thesis. I think it's very interesting. So for people who want to know more about this, you know, you'll share some resources a bit later. But let's get into the book that you're currently writing. Tell us a bit more about that.
Okay, so I actually would like to start off by just saying that, you know, what I have a research partner, so Dr. Rachel Samuel, she's from UiT Malacca. She's a lecturer there. So she and me are looking together in this book. And what interests us is that when we looked at research, for example, by Ipsos in 2018, it revealed that there are about, you know, 8-10 issues that women face in Malaysia. But in terms of their study on women's equality issues in Malaysia, the top three was on sexual harassment. Second was on sexual violence. These are what women experiences in Malaysia. And third is on sexualization of women in the media. So sexual harassment is a predominant issue that women still face in Malaysia. And because of that, we decided to actually come up with this book proposal to look at how does news then, again, you know, from a news angle, how does news report issues of sexual violence in the newspaper, for example, on rape? And why is that important? Because the media actually, you know, in a way, shapes an understanding of what rape is about. But however, like I said, besides the media, there's also cultural and religious understanding of that issue. But we're looking at how the media reports it, because it does, in a way, influence at some extent. So we're looking at a 5-year study. And Dr. Rachel and I actually had discussed that, you know, a lot of these books, actually, there are a lot of books that talks about gender equality and all that in Malaysia, but they're in the academic domain. And the problem with that is that when it's in the academic domain, you have very limited group of people reading it. Right. So we want to have a book that, you know, it's a bit more open to, you know, anyone that wants to read it versus writing it in an academic jargon that then, you know, you limit to only a certain population of society that looks at
exactly.
it. So, yeah, so that's what we're trying to look at, you know, like a 5-year study between 2015 to 2020. And explores again, you know, maybe about 10, 15 online newspapers and look at what are the differences.
Mm. So what are some of the really interesting facts and maybe stories that you can share that's part of the book? You know, what's interesting about the book? For me as a normal reader, not to want to buy the book from an academic perspective, to want to buy your book and want to read your book, right? So what can you share?
Well, I think the book will have, I guess, two perspectives. One is, you know, Dr. Rachel would actually look at some statistics and facts about what are gender violence issue in Malaysia. So we're going to look at police statistics and data, you know, to say, you know, how many percent of rape is being reported, what are the gender violence and all that. So there will be that kind of factual and latest information. And of course, the second part will look at, you know, the media itself and how they would be covering issues like this and whether it matches. Because if you look at the newspaper at the moment, there are a lot of issues reported in the media. For example, you have celebrity preachers. I don't know whether you've been following that, had, you know, rape cases and all that. So it's been interesting to see the actual data, you know, what's actually happening in Malaysia in terms of gender violence, and actually what is the media reporting. Because as you know, the media does have an agenda, as I was saying. They mold the story, and, you know, it's the stories that they're reporting on gender violence actually reflects what's on the ground. And of course, a book like this, there's very few books like this being written in Malaysia. There's a lot of books like this being written in, you know, in America, in the UK and so forth. So this is actually a different perspective of, you know, talking about issues like this.
Yeah, that sounds great. So I think, you know, just peeling through this very difficult topic is really interesting. But what I'm also, you know, curious about, and of course, you know, I have my biases based on what I read, for example, right? So when you talk about, you know, gender equality on sexual harassment specifically, you know, there is there like a race issue that kind of exists as an undertone or background, because sometimes when I read a lot of these rape cases, sexual harassment cases, it seems to be a majority of it happening amongst the Malay community and Muslim community again. And also, you know, recently I was reading the book by our ex-AG, Tommy Thomas, Wilderness, yes. Justice in Wilderness. And, you know, he also mentioned that the state of Selangor is very, they are worried about the rising number of rape and sexual harassment abuses and violence cases, particularly because it's happening within the Malay Muslim community. And I think that's very interesting, because we've allocated a lot of money, particularly from our budget, to help with these sorts of issues, but we still seem unable to solve it, or seem unable to come up with a system that helps these communities. And it's a commonly recurring event. So just wondering, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, that's definitely, I mean, like you said, you correctly put it, there's a lot of cases being reported that, you know, from an outside, we see it's predominantly, you know, the Malays that's involved in, you know, sexual violence. But however, if you look at the statistics of Malaysia in terms of population ratio, the Malays is, you know, about 60-70%.
Right.
So then again, you have to see how does that balance, because, you know, the Malay population is the largest population and by ratio it's high. So that is that because of that is, you know, obviously it's reported higher, or if you look at a statistic and compare it in breakdown with the Chinese and Indian by ratio, and then find that yes, the Malay is still higher regardless of that ratio, then you have to look at it into a deeper context, like what you say, why, you know, why is it still happening? And of course you see a lot of issues like incest, you know, that's being reported a lot. And, you know, when we read a lot of other gender violence book in other countries, incest does happen, but not as, you know, rampant as what we see that's happening in Malaysia, for example. So again, issues like that, we need to really see it in a deeper perspective.
Yeah, but I find we're not really getting into like the why, right? Mm. So I'm still trying to understand. So, you know, let's say there's 10, out of like 100%, right? 60% Malay. So if I was to read, you know, cases about rape, sexual harassment or sexualization of women, then I should, following the statistics, I would read 6 stories about the Malays, 3 stories about the Chinese, and, you know, maybe 1 or 2 stories on the Indian. But, you know, the honest fact is that I rarely see Chinese, you know, these issues happening within the Chinese community, more so in the Malay community and then the Indian community. So what would be interesting is to kind of understand, you know, what are the reasons for that? And I think, you know, I'm trying to get that out of you, and I haven't really gotten, like, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, the reason that I haven't given you a specific answer is because we're still, you know, writing the book. And like I said, you know, it's something that you have to go deeper into a data than, you know, for me to actually tell you the specific reason of why, you know, like you said, you see more of the Malays being reported. And it'd be interesting to, you know, once we finish it, I can tell you exactly what our findings are.
Okay, so we have to have a second recording, second podcast session after the findings. So when will this book be ready?
Well, we're looking at it within, you know, usually a book takes between 1 to 2 years. It's not a, you know, a short-term thing. So we're looking at that kind of timeline.
Okay, so 2022?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So to all the audience, you know, I hope you also, you know, all of you would also be looking forward to reading this book as you know, I am. So another question that I have here is, you know, why is it critical to, you know, have the discussion on gender equality and violence against women and girls today? It's not a new issue. It didn't happen yesterday. It didn't happen 5 years ago. You know, this has been happening for centuries. And yet it feels like we are still not speaking enough about it. You know, everything's been kind of like shoved aside. We don't really want to confront the hard, honest truths of what's really happening in this, our society. So in your opinion, what's really holding this discussion back?
Well, I guess the first and foremost is we have to unpack, you know, what gender equality means, you know, and basically it's that term of, you know, men and women having, you know, equal opportunities, regardless of their gender. So I guess we need to really question, are men and women really equal in Malaysia in terms of laws?
They're not.
Yeah, so yeah. You have answered.
I don't need to do research. We know we're not, right?
Yeah, so because of that, we really need, you know, gender equality urgently in our society, because as we just spoke about, you know, if you have gender equality, violence against women will not happen. The fact that there's a lot of violence against women happening, like, you know, during the recent MCO, Talian Kasih had reported there was a rise in gender, you know, so because of all this happening, gender equality is very important for us to discuss and still discuss. Like you say, it's not something new. People have been talking for it for decades. But the fact that all these things are happening in Malaysia, which means that we really, really still need to talk about it. And I think what's happening in Malaysia is that Malaysian women still face a lot of barriers. For example, the challenges that a Malaysian woman face, that they have to still juggle the responsibility of family as well as, you know, their paid work. That itself, you know, puts a lot of women back a step. For example, like I'm sure you've had, you know, a lot of my friends, we went to uni together, they went to top universities, you know, London School of Economics and all that. As soon as they get married, they have children, what happens? They stop working. And then you know, when financially you're not earning, there's already inequality because you don't have a lot of say in terms of, you know, the household, the family, what you can do, what you can't do. So that inequality is not, it's already not there. And of course, you know, when you have responsibilities at home, it's not recognized as work. It's just, oh, you're a woman, you should be doing that. And of course, traditional attitudes towards women in Malaysia, that it's the woman's role to actually do all this. So again, the question is, why can't a man help out or, you know, take equal roles? Or if you see, for example, in New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, she's the Prime Minister of New Zealand, and she's just had a baby, and who's actually taking care of the child is the husband, who has a career in the broadcasting. Mind you, he's not someone who's not been working. He has a career, but he has stepped down to become a house husband while she becomes the Prime Minister. He takes care. He becomes a full-time house husband. So coming back to this question, how many men would do that in Malaysia? Step down from the career, you know, take care
almost of none. Probably almost none. Okay, so I have my filters and biases on, right?
So, you know, how many men would actually do that? So there's that constant inequality issue. The other thing, of course, like I said, you know, that's when you look at, you know, social and cultural issues. The other thing is also policies in place. For example, inadequate parental leave policies, or, you know, proper policies in the labor market. If you look at countries like, you know, the UK or Australia, if a woman has a child, she can take 1 year off for maternity. And then when she goes back, she's given a choice of maybe just working twice a week and yet hold her position, let's say as a lawyer. And as the child grows back, grows up, she slowly comes back into the workforce. Again, in Malaysia, it's very limited to have that kind of support. It's either, there are some companies, but most companies is, you know, once you have kids, you know, you want to come back. If you don't, we'll replace you. So all these things has become a barrier for Malaysian women, and that has caused a lot of inequality.
Yeah, I think, you know, everything that you've said, statistics that, you know, if people were to read on the news, etc., you know, these are available, particularly from, you know, organizations like Sisters in Islam. They would also publish you know, a lot of the statistics and information, particularly with regards to regulations, policies and laws. I think the elephant in the room is really is boiled down to culture and religion. Right, so these are like the two areas that many people try to avoid like the plague and talk about everything else but this too. So using culture and religion, basically, you know, a majority of our population has been dumbed down. I mean, that is the truth that we have to confront, right? So in our education system, if you kind of remember, I'm not sure which education system you used, but I went through the normal public schools,
yes,
went to smart school, right? Yeah. And so I feel personally that, you know, from a young age, I have been indoctrinated by this culture and by the religion to basically tell me that I am not allowed to question anything. I cannot question authority. I cannot question the teachers. I cannot question things that I learn about the religion, even though it should be very valid for me to understand why certain things are, you know, done in certain ways. But we've never cultivated a culture of inquiry or allowed to express our curiosity. And that alone disables us. It basically chops off, you know, a part of our mental ability to think. And I think that's the most important part that we need to address, starting from the education system, right? And the way how, you know, a lot of things that you brought up, which is the expectations on women. So that role in terms of reversing it or not reversing it, or just like, you know, bringing women, giving women the equity so that they are able to, you know, be at the same platform as men. No, men and women are not equal, but on the same platform in terms of like responsibilities, in terms of, you know, career progression, in terms of work responsibility. So what is it that's preventing us or preventing that from happening? What is the real crux? You know, so again, I feel that our society uses religion over and over again to basically, you know, the male has to be in front and the female has to be the back. And the reason why female accepts this is because there's a higher thing there. That basically the religion says this. So it is therefore unquestionable and therefore true. And so, you know, women just kind of play around this. And so that's why we have to confront the real elephant in the room, which is, you know, religion and culture. And I hope that comes out through in your book as well, you know, being able to peel through these issues. And, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess, you know, like I said just now, there are, like I said, it's social issues, cultural issues, religious issues, and also, you know, policies in place to support women that causes that gender inequality. So you're right, Pial, because when I did my PhD in the age of 40s as a mother, I was the only mom in that whole PhD cohort. Everyone was, you know, either they were young, most of them were single. You know, because, you know, the higher you go, the more lonely it gets as a woman.
Right.
Because like you said, everything is pulling you down because you are expected to do a lot of, you know, household responsibilities and so forth. So I noticed the more I went into my studies, the more I went into a certain position, it got very lonely. And I'm sure that you've seen, you know, you go into a boardroom, you know, like now if I go into meetings, I'm one of the few women that's there. What happened to everyone else that's my age? You know, it's like you turn around, they're smart, they are capable. I'm sure a lot more capable than, you know, what I am. But like, you're right, there are a lot of social cultural issues that, you know, pulls a woman down. And like you said, you know, as you go to a certain time, it becomes very lonely. And the funny part is that, you know, the fact that I had to manage, you know, while you have a kid and all that, on the flip side, actually made you sane because, you know, then you sort of switched off, you know, and this is the time I study, this is the time I do, this is the time. But you're right, it's not an easy platform.
Yeah, I completely resonate with the example that you just shared. You know, recently I've been promoted. And so I am now, thank you. So I am, you know, trying to schedule meetings with friends. And I realized that, hey, actually, right, it's going to be a room full of testosterone energy because, you know, I'll be the only woman in at that meeting. So it does become lonelier as you go higher. And I think that's one of the messages which I want the audience to hear, right? Is that, you know, you have to help yourself, number one. Breaking through this ceiling, this invisible ceiling, is already difficult enough as we have just discussed it. And therefore, so find your support system, you know, reach out to sisters around your network who have your best interests in mind. Reach out to Thera, reach out to myself, you know, so you can create a support system to help you go up, whatever that may mean, even in a corporate ladder or just, you know, in society. So there are many ways. And one of the things which I want to just bring up here to the audience's attention is that because you know, women have been in a way suppressed using religion, and therefore it's very difficult for them to want to push. So because they're kept in this level, so whenever they see another woman being able to break through that barrier, it now becomes an issue. It's like jealousy, envy, and all these other feelings that we don't talk about. And usually it's not part of like a case study because it's feelings, right? Mm. So feelings, you start to become like a woo-woo thing. Mm. Something that is not tangible for us to be able to kind of put, you know, what are the hard statistics or facts to support this? But this pressure, societal pressure from other women, basically continue to remain within this circle is very real and it's very strong. And so many women, you know, whenever given an opportunity to climb up the ladder, this choose to stay and remain here just because friends are basically saying, oh, you know, Sara, you know, action lah, or, you know, people are talking about you behind your back. And these issues, it really impacts a woman mentally and emotionally, and it is a real issue. And I've seen this again and again in corporations, amongst professionals, because I'm in that space, right? As particularly institutions where majority are Malays.
Yes.
It doesn't just happen within women, even for the men. Even men face the same pressure to conform. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, if you're going to have the opportunity to have a salary raise or, you know, go up the career ladder. And then you have people saying, oh, so now you've left us. You've gone to a different level now. And people ostracize you. And that pressure is real. So yes, we need to build a society that is supportive of one another. Yeah. That is collective. You know, that we are as a society want everyone to succeed for the collective well-being of Malaysia. And I think that's missing in our formula as part of nation building. So that's like a really, really big topic, right? So
I just like to add, I mean, you brought a very interesting point. I think, you know, as a woman, one of the most important thing you need to have is courage. You know, courage not to go against the tide, courage to, you know, to stand strong, and, you know, courage to have your voice heard. Like you said, you go into a board meeting, you always have to have the courage to speak up and to make sure you're taken very seriously. I agree with you at that point of, you know, when you are going up the ladder and you need support, for example, you have three kids at home. I think what I've learned is that, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. Yes. And you can tap on a different energy, a positive energy of having a tribe that to help you in that position of, you know, when you have kids. It's not necessarily a tribe of just the husband or your partner, but a tribe of supportive people. It can be auntie, uncles, friends, you know, best friend to help you in that tribe or in that village while you go up, you know, to help raise your kids in the meantime.
Yeah, so I think that's a great, great, important addition point that you made there. I was going to ask you, so what are the one or two profound messages you'd like to leave the listeners with? I think you've covered a lot there already.
Yeah, but
is there any more that you'd like to add? Maybe something that you prepared?
Like I said, you know, I think that tribe thing is important. It's a collective energy that's, you know, the most important for women empowerment. You can't do it alone. It's impossible. And collectively, we can be empowered and tap on the positive energy. Like you said, there's always energy out there that wants to bring you down, regardless of gender. Because like you said, men and women go through that. I mean, my male colleagues also said they have people. So I think if you have tapping on positive collective energy, having the courage, and, you know, that would give us a lot of empowerment, and that can lead to gender equality.
Yeah, thank you. I think that really wrapped it around nicely in terms of, you know, we went big and then we narrowed it down, went peeled through all the, you know, difficult conversations, elephants in the room, and then so we've come a full circle. Thank you so much, Sara, for being with us this afternoon. One last question, right? So are there any best that you would recommend, or in your recommendation, books, non-academy books, for those who'd like to take the understanding and discussion further?
Okay, non-academic books. All right. I think one interesting book that if the listeners would like to read is The Moment of Lift by Melinda Gates. Have you read?
I haven't.
Okay. So she actually talks about the same thing. You know, when you lift up a woman everybody in the family, in the community, will be lifted. Like I said, the empowered woman. And of course, Melinda Gates, you know, being, you know, having a lot of resources and facilities, she actually interviewed a lot of inspiring stories of women around the world. And I think this book is, it's very important for women to read and understand what it means to be empowered, why gender equality is important, and how do you get into that platform?
Great. Thank you so much, Sarah, for your time. I've taken copious notes for me to be able to extract all the great quotes. So I hope the listeners and the audience have enjoyed our session. So thank you and have an enjoy your weekend. And we'll speak to you soon when the book is ready.
Thank you, Pierre. Yeah.
So if people would like to reach out to you, Sarah, to find out a bit more about your thesis or, you know, wanting to know more information from you, how would they be able to reach you?
Well, I guess they can either email me at tiaray74@yahoo.com.
Yep. Or what about social media?
Are you on social media? Yeah, I'm on Facebook. So either, you know, send me a message through Facebook.
Okay, cool. Great. Thank you so much. All right, take care.
Thank you so much for listening in. If you liked it, give it a thumbs up, subscribe, leave a comment, and share with your friends. Be sure to tune in to the next episode. And to find out how to be part of Societal Shapers, head to www.plcadilla.com and check out our coaching programs. Catch you soon!